Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we continue our series, Leaving Afghanistan. It's a series of conversations in which we ask Iowa veterans of the Afghanistan War to reflect on their deployments and the U.S. troop withdrawal from that war-torn country after 20 years. My guest this hour is Eric Eldridge. He's a retired major in the U.S. Marine Corps, a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy. He grew up in eastern Iowa in the town of Keystone, just west of Cedar Rapids. He was deployed to Afghanistan from March of 2010 to March of 2011. He's currently a senior systems engineer at Collins Aerospace in Cedar Rapids. He's married, has kids, even has some grandkids. Major Eldridge, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. Go ahead and call me Eric.
Will do. Take us back to the time that you were deployed in 2010. This has been such a long war. We have to go back a few phases. In the evolution of this war, how it was going at that point for the Afghan government, the military, and the coalition allies along with the U.S.?
So in spring of 2010, we had in Afghanistan kind of a surge, much like we had in Iraq. So there was an increase in the NATO security forces and U.S. Security forces. In my particular case, our Marine presence went from right around probably 8,000 to double to triple of that, where Marine Expeditionary Brigade was replaced by a Marine Expeditionary Force Forward out of Camp Pendleton, California. And I was a part of that two-star headquarters element that stood up down in Helmand Province. At the time, it was Regional Command Southwest, so it was a NATO command at that point in time. It was actually led by the Brits, the UK, and after we rolled in, 10th Mountain Division took over in in Kandahar, and we, as the Marines, took over in Helmand in Nimruz Province, which is in the southwest corner of Afghanistan, butting up against Iran and Pakistan.
So you were already in country on the ground when the surge happened under Obama, or did this happen just before you went there?
I was part. My unit was actually part
of the surge,
part of that increase in forces. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Describe the overall goals you had in your command when you arrived in 2010.
So our command was primarily focused on the individuals in the indigenous population there to allow them to be more self-sufficient, not tied to the Taliban, certainly not tied to Poppy, although that was kind of a double-edged sword.
Poppy.
So black tar opium, we've commonly known out here as heroin. But Helmand Province at the time, and even previous to that, was, I think, the number one location for the production of black tar opium in the world. And there was reasons for that. But one of the things we hoped to do with the Afghans was to enable them to kind of wean themselves off of the poppy crops and getting back into things that were more durable goods, if you will.
Give me your first impressions of the country when you arrived in 2010. You were stationed on the East Coast before that, or where were you immediately prior to
deployed? So I was stationed out of Quantico, Virginia, which is just south of Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. and I had a small detachment of Marines that we went and joined the Marine Expeditionary Force that was deploying actually out of Camp Pendleton. So we went from Northern Virginia to Camp Pendleton and then onward into Afghanistan. Some of the things that were pretty amazing were, I remember flying into into the country the first time, and the mountains were unbelievable.
Like Colorado?
They would dwarf Colorado. So a lot of the mountains, especially the area we flew into up north, it's not uncommon to have peaks above 20,000 feet.
Mm.
So substantial terrain. Of course, when we got where we were at down in Southwest, a lot of sand and talcum powder type sand. It was the most unbelievable thing you'd ever seen. You'd step in it and it was like, we'd call it moon dust because you'd step into like 6 inches of, it was talcum powder consistency.
And if there's any wind,
it creates, yes, these huge dust storms. And it almost looks like if anybody saw The Mummy with Brendan Fraser, where the face comes out, it's, we had a few of those types of dust storms, yes.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about your specific role in your command when you arrived. Perhaps that changed over the course of the year. What were your first missions?
So at the two-star headquarters, I was a advanced planner. So I participated in what was the organization going to do writ large over the course of the next 12 to 18 months, as well as near-term operations to be able to achieve our objectives, transferring power to the local governments, the local security forces, and those sorts of things. So it was very diffuse. It was not your typical just military, go out and do military stuff. It was very much interactive with the host populations, the leadership, and those sorts of things.
So, well, what were you negotiating? Were you talking strategy? What were you doing?
So,
conversations.
A lot of what we were doing was taking a look at what types of capabilities we had to be able to utilize in a given operation. And sometimes that was your traditional force-on-force, clearing an area of Taliban and clearing it of improvised explosive devices, which were very prevalent in Afghanistan. I think Afghanistan is the most heavily mined country in the world previous to us going there. And of course, they were very adept at using homemade explosives as well. So a lot of that, but also trying to establish what we would reflect as local governance and being able to provide goods and services and you know, a lot of things that we would take for granted, maybe not necessarily like, you know, mm-hmm. our normal taxes that occur that pay for roads and goods and services. A lot of that doesn't happen there. There's not a centralized government like we would see here, the federal government going on all the way down to the local level. It's a very much tribal society, I guess.
So a real challenge would be to figure out when you met new people where their allegiance was, could they be trusted?
A lot of that, yes, that was very true. I remember sitting at Lashkar Gah, which is the provincial capital in Helmand, and I forget who was actually conducting the interview, but it was with a religious leader. And I just remember him after we got the interpretation, he had basically alluded to the fact that the Taliban was very much a force to be reckoned with, and that from a religious standpoint, you know, it could be, their credibility could be undermined, you know, with the right sort of, I would call it tribute. So it was odd. Hearing that, you know, especially from a Western standpoint.
So it was about money?
Not necessarily money. It was more about honor. So how do you get honor over there, especially in our area, which is dominated by the Pashtun tribe? that level of hospitality where, you know, I'm asking for sanctuary. If you're asked for that, mm-hmm. you're obligated, you know, otherwise you're dishonored. And, you know, yes, money helps, but land, the ability to, you know, provide security, provide food, provide clothing for your family, your tribe, and things of that nature were really key. And being a male-dominated society, you couldn't have a wife until you could basically support a wife. And pretty tough to do when you're in Afghanistan, especially in that area, desert region, pretty bleak. But here's the Taliban offering, you know, goods and services. Hey, why don't you go ahead and plant IEDs over here and we'll, you know, pay you X, Y, or Z. It was a very easy way for people to do a side hustle. Let's put it that way.
Right. So it was about their tribe, about their family surviving. What was the overall view of the way they saw the Americans, the allies' view? Did they mesh together or mesh when it was convenient, when the tribute was right? It seems like you're speaking different languages, figuratively, in terms of the culture that we were there to, perhaps broadly speaking, liberate them, improve their society from our perspective. And they were looking as individuals and as families for something else.
I would say, and this is broadly, you know, one person's opinion, of course, probably not endorsed by anybody, but I would say that they were very, very pragmatic. They weren't very well educated, but we oftentimes, I think, especially as Westerners, we put a premium on education, and that doesn't necessarily equate real well over there because they were very, what my wife would call street smart. maybe not book smart, but extremely pragmatic in
street
that
smart
sense.
What would be an example of an Afghan individual being street smart over there?
So I know these Americans are not going to be here forever because the Americans have never stayed anywhere forever. Therefore, I'm going to milk them like a cash cow as long as they are here, you know, for my benefit in the here and the now. And that's
while smiling at you.
While smiling, yes. And so one person that dealt with tribes at a very local level said it was kind of like working with the mob, how they would envision working with the mob, you know, after watching some of these police shows that we have, you know, CSI or whatnot. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, they're crooked and you can, but it's their country, it's their way of doing business. And although, you know, you trust them to a certain extent, you would never fully trust them. And others had totally different experiences.
If you've just joined us, my guest this hour, Eric Eldridge, he's a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, retired major in the U.S. Marine Corps, native Iowan from Keystone. He grew up just west of Cedar Rapids. He now works at Collins Aerospace as a senior systems engineer. He was deployed to Afghanistan in 2010 and 2011. So your specific role in these liaisons, these situations with tribal leaders was what? What were you doing in the room?
A lot of mine was, like I said, it was planning, trying to set the conditions, set things up as far as what direction are we going and why. And I just played a very small part on the two-star level command. Because of some of my background and experience, we dealt with some very different items. So I spent a lot of time with our adjacent command over in Kandahar. Spent a lot of time up in Regional Command East, Bagram. You may have seen that recently on
The Bagram airport is vacant now.
It's vacant. It was a huge place at that time. 82nd Airborne Division was the two-star command, American command in there. And spent a lot of time also in Kabul proper, up at the ISAF Joint Headquarters, which was the 3-star command, and ISAF, which was the 4-star command that dealt, I would say, at an ambassador level and those sorts of things. So as a major, going all over and
working with a lot of coalition forces, other countries.
A huge amount of coalition forces. Our regional command actually ended up being composite. So when we got there as Marines, we knew we were going to stand up a new NATO command, regional command Southwest. And we were quickly augmented by various UK officers and forces. And it was probably one of the most professionally rewarding opportunities I ever had, not only being a Marine, which we're kind of used to dealing with other services, being, you know, the smallest with the less, but do the most with it. Mm-hmm. But being dropped in, working with Australians, working with Canadians, working with UK, did a lot of work with French and other NATO allies as far as coordinating stuff. And so it was really almost like being on Mars at some point in time, but it was truly a really rewarding experience.
Yeah, you've said it was without a doubt, to quote you, without a doubt the best and worst year of your life. I don't know if we want to own that quote still, but
true story. Yeah,
true story. Okay, so you've described some of the best, the work with coalition forces, and I assume that means you feel you were making a difference in those people's lives.
Yes, I think at that time and space, yes.
Eric, take me to the worst of that year.
One of my collateral duties was part of what was called an incident response team. And at the time, the Taliban was very adept at propaganda. A lot of times taking something that was somewhat factual and spinning it in such a way that it was, you know, 100% false. So one of the challenges we had as U.S. was, you know, hey, what are the facts? Not necessarily, hey, we're not doing an investigation, if you will, but just trying to understand what were the actual facts on the ground and correlate those and capture those and be able to pass those up quickly. Two incidents that really, like I said, stick with me. One was in July. The other one was in November. The first one in July was in the 1st Royal Gurkha Regiment. So that's a UK formation. They had what we would hear back here is a green on blue, where a partnered Afghan individual or unit would take NATO or U.S. forces under fire. In this case, one Afghan soldier decided he'd had enough, and he basically killed the commanding officer, the executive officer, and one of the senior NCOs of the Royal Gurkhas out at this patrol base before vacating. Something very similar in November also occurred in a Marine unit where a Marine out in a shared position, security position, was shot and killed by his Afghan partner, who then slipped through the wire and out to the woods they went. So actually seeing where this happened, talking with folks who were there or firsthand removed, kind of sticks with you.
I'm sure tough to handle, tough to understand, but what about those follows you to this day? What aspect?
I think it was, for me, trying to reflect back on it and kind of go into, you know, the worst. It really exposed the worst biases and basis of humanity. You know, seeing humanity at its worst up close and personal, or a little snippet of it, where you know, it doesn't get much worse than that when you're supposedly partnered with another unit, and having something like that occur is you know, such a violation of trust, And, you know, basically it's murder. I mean, in a lot of cases.
And wouldn't it make you, if you're in the direct vicinity of this happening, makes you behave differently? Has to.
It certainly makes you have your head on a swivel. Another one was on July 22nd, 2010. Someone I knew that was flying a AH-1 Super Cobra was taken under fire. He was supporting troops in contact in the Trek Nawa region, which is just north of Marja. They got shot down. And so Lieutenant Colonel Caruso, Sugar Bear, was somebody that I served with at up at the planning level, so I knew him pretty well. He was 2 years ahead of me at the Naval Academy. So having, you know, it was hard having Marines in general or people in general, you know, going back in caskets. But when you actually had somebody, you know, like I said, that's probably one of those dates that is going to, I'm going to carry forward for the rest of my life type thing.
You mentioned Sugar Bear as someone you'll always think of, a nickname for a fellow Marine who fell. You are a supporter of what is called the Sugar Bear Foundation. Take a moment to tell us about that. I looked at the website. It looks like really a worthwhile campaign.
Yes. So Sugar Bear Memorial Foundation is named after Lieutenant Colonel Caruso. His call sign was Sugar Bear. It was started by his wife, and the whole purpose of the Sugar Bear Foundation is to provide support to Gold Star families, specifically spouses and children of fallen service members. For me, that's near and dear to my heart because I know most of us veterans get thanked. Oh, you're a veteran. You know, thanks for your service. And really, the folks who really deserve the thanks are our spouses and kids. They didn't put their hand up in the air and swear an oath. You know, they either married into it or were born into it. And so, a foundation such as this that provides those spouses left behind and kids that were left behind advanced opportunities, I think, is a tremendous organization. So if anyone's interested, please, by all means, take a look at the foundation.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back. If you've just joined us, my guest this hour, Eric Eldridge, retired major in the U.S. Marine Corps, served in Afghanistan from March of 2010 to March of 2011. He currently works at Collins Aerospace in Cedar Rapids. It's our Leaving Afghanistan series. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll be back in just a moment.
Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com. This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This is our Leaving Afghanistan series, where we talk with Iowa veterans of that war about their service to our country. And it really spans, of course, a wide range over the 20 years of this war and all kinds of duties they did for this country in the efforts to improve that country, Afghanistan. My guest today is Eric Eldridge, graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, retired major in the U.S. Marine Corps, native Iowan from Keystone. He served in Afghanistan from March 2010 to March 2011. Last half hour, you talked a little bit about, it sounded like you were, the Taliban, not only war on the ground, but information war, disinformation there too. Do you have other examples of that you were having to fight against while you were there?
Like
maybe an incident happens, somebody's killed or injured, and you're responding to that with what you see as the facts, and the Taliban is trying to spin it their way.
Yes. So I do have a for instance, so firsthand account. This one actually occurred up in the vicinity of Sangin. Sangin is in northern Helmand province. It's in the green zone right off of the Helmand River. Definitely a Taliban stronghold. Even when we were there, you could look out in the city and see white flags flying, which were indicated you were a supporter of the Taliban. In this case, there was supposedly a number of individuals who were killed in combat operations. You know, usually what would come up is, hey, women and children. And they would, these elders would come and basically seek retribution of some sort or compensation. And in this particular case, the Marines were taking fire from they could see incoming rounds. They had them, had it documented on ISR, so drone type stuff. So when it was destroyed, they knew it was, no kidding, an enemy position. But these elders came down and were saying, no, there were women and children that were killed. And I was with the senior representative of this incident response team because we were getting rumbling. So we went up there and I told him, I said, you know, this is not true, right? And he goes, well, Eric, how do you know that? And I said, well, if you notice, you've got all these gray beards. So in Afghanistan, gray beard, especially any that were dyed with a red henna, they were kind of hey, this is somebody who's important. Mm. But behind them had a very 20-something-year-old individual that seemed to be their handler. One of the things I learned in Naval Postgraduate School, I had an instructor who were pretty sure he probably was working for a three-letter agency during the late 80s, running during the Mujahideen time period when the Russians were there. And he gave us some of the tools of the trade as far as being able to kind of read, I guess you'd call it, symbology. And you could tell by this guy's turban, I was like, well, number one, he's too young to be, you know, leading this, but that guy's Taliban. And sure enough, they weren't really getting what they wanted. And I watched this guy pull out a cell phone, and the interpreter said he's calling Karzai. And Karzai at the time was the president of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. To talk about, you know, to tell him about this atrocity that had happened in Sangin. And sure enough, 10 minutes later, you've got President Karzai going out to the international media talking about these atrocities that the Americans had perpetrated up in Sangin. So you want to talk about a quick turnaround, you know. So a lot of those individuals, once again, very tribally based. It's not necessarily where you are in a pecking zone. It's the who you know. So that was pretty interesting, seeing how fast information could travel.
And they've got cell phone coverage all over the country, this vast mountainous country?
Well, that was rather interesting. Everybody had a cell phone, whether you had cell phone coverage or not. Cell phone coverage was established in Afghanistan. But interestingly enough, the Taliban also had means and methods of controlling, turning cell phone towers on and off, or at least being able to turn off the backbone. So, I've got a cell signal, but it's not, I can't call anybody.
The Taliban had control over that network in a lot of areas, and they could really hamper. Was that also military communications they could shut off?
No. This was specifically for the civilian population. And it wasn't necessarily that they had control, such as, you know, here in the control booth that I can turn the radio on and off, but it was more of a, hey, Ben, I know where you live. I know your wife and your kids, and I really need you to turn the radio off between this time period and this time period, with the implied or else. Mm. And so we had, we saw a lot of those sorts of intimidation type things.
Mm-hmm. Did you, Eric, get into, what was the most dicey situation you got into personally? Were there any moments when you feared for your life?
It's one of my funnies, I guess, but, some of the stuff I was doing, I had to be in civilian clothes, so I was not in uniform, because of some of the, I'll say, organizations I was dealing with. So I happened to be up at ISAF headquarters, which is kind of up in the hills of Kabul, and I was going to, usually you'll be on some sort of a convoy that takes you from point A to point B. And so I was up there ready to get on this convoy and waited. Well, the convoy never materialized. And so I went to check on it, and sure enough, it had been canceled. So I was like, well, hey, I got to get down to the airport to catch a flight. So it's like, okay, just stand by. We'll get this fixed. And out comes this, turns out he was a private in the French army, spoke very broken English. And he said, oh, Major Eldridge. And I'm like, yes. He goes, oh, I'm your driver. Let us go. And I'm like, I'm looking around, and he's goes and gets the keys to a Mercedes up armored vehicle. And, I don't know if anybody's watched any of those Western shows where you have somebody who's riding shotgun. Well, I quickly found that I was the individual riding shotgun on my own convoy. So yeah, we were a single vehicle going through the streets of Kabul at the time, and it looks a lot like downtown LA traffic in a lot of cases. Luckily, I think this private was probably from Paris. Because he
could navigate,
he could navigate, and he could drive like a wild man. But that was probably the most on edge. And I had other similar instances, but in larger convoys. But this one was certainly the hairiest one, because if anything would have happened, we were going to be in dire straits. And
even in an armored vehicle,
yeah.
You just joined us. Eric Eldridge, my guest, retired major in the U.S. Marine Corps, served in Afghanistan in 2010 and 2011. Let's talk a little bit about, get your thoughts on the U.S. mission overall with the withdrawal of all U.S. troops. One of the quotes that I picked out, I wonder if you agree with this, President Biden, this person said, pick the best of many poor choices. Does that sound accurate? Does that ring true with you?
I would say yes. And I was sharing with someone earlier that if we look at history there in that particular region, that this should not come as a surprise. I think one of the best enduring quotes of Afghanistan is, it's easy to march into, hard to march out of. And that was by Alexander the Great, you know, millennia ago, when he went and occupied and tried to set down roots there in Afghanistan. In fact, Kandahar is Alexander. It's just the local dialect. So little useless knowledge for anyone who plays Jeopardy, I guess, about Afghanistan. But yes, I think it's very difficult to come at that particular area of the world with a Western mindset, because it is so foreign as far as how things are and how the individuals operate. And to be quite honest, I think what we're seeing now, I was just watching the news today, and they were showing, oh my gosh, the Taliban's doing X, Y, and Z. Anyone who has looked at even contemporary Afghanistan and Central Asia in that particular area shouldn't be surprised at this. This should be like, yeah, no kidding, this was going to happen, just because of the tribal dynamics that are in play, and we're just witnessing it again.
I'm going to ask you to be a geopolitical scientist here in just a moment. Here, is there any scenario, any way that the U.S. and its allies could have worked in the last 20 years under four presidents that would have had more success than what is today the case?
Wow, that's a loaded one. I think potentially looking at it as we were talking about from the bottom up versus from the top down. If we take a look at what worked in Afghanistan, or maybe not so much worked, but it was certainly it's a bottom up society.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to come at it with a very monolithic, centralized, hey, we've got this new thing called the Afghan Constitution that we put together. I mean, how long did it take us to put together our constitution? You know, took a while, a few decades. And to have kind of our Western values replicated in Afghanistan and their constitution, I mean, that's just a piece of paper. I mean, you've got areas in Afghanistan, especially down along southern Afghanistan, where you have literally houses that are in Pakistan, half of the houses in Pakistan, half of the houses in Afghanistan, and they don't recognize those international borders because it's all tribal land and they're in some cases very nomadic. So when you're taking a very rural viewpoint that very transient population and trying to overlay a first world, top-down, strong centralized government, yeah, instilling democracy, or our version, I should say, of democracy, I think that's pretty difficult.
Let me ask you about your thoughts on the people of Afghanistan. What do you think now about them, about their fate? Should they feel the U.S. has abandoned them?
I don't think so, and here's why. As I kind of mentioned tongue-in-cheek, the U.S. is not there as an occupier. I think from the information, quote-unquote, war standpoint, if we would have said that as soon as we went in, it's like, look, here's what I can tell you. I don't know when the U.S. is leaving, but what I can tell you is we are leaving at some point in time. We're not interested in making Afghanistan the 51st state of the United States. I think that would have probably been helpful. But I think what you're going to see is some people were pragmatic and they'll probably be okay. It's kind of like the Hatfields and McCoys. That would be the nearest U.S. example of, you know, a blood feud. There is going to be retribution taken. There will be vengeance that's going to be extracted on these individuals and their families. It's unfortunate, but that is the reality of that area in the world.
Right. At this moment in time, when we're talking, there is supposedly a process to help those Afghans who were involved with coalition forces. So tens of thousands of Afghans added to our culture here because of this, similar to the way we had an influx of Asians, East Asians after the Vietnam era as well.
Yep. Yes.
Do you think that's where the similarities end, or?
Are we abandoning Afghanistan? I don't believe that's necessarily the case. Certainly our military footprint has been pulled back. I think President Biden has probably done a decent job of trying to go, okay, our core reasons for being there have been met, and trying to solidify that and say, okay, we're done. Probably could have been done a long time ago. Mm-hmm. But I think getting caught in the challenges of, we would call it, I think people have called it, nation building or winning hearts and minds and things of that nature. I think in order to be successful in something like that, you instead of coming at it with, I've got the answers, you really have to go, what is it that's going to work, and is it going to be sustainable once we leave? It's pretty hard to have a lot of the stuff we take for granted institute, you know, kind of that Western way of looking at things when you don't have the foundational elements there.
In the final few minutes of our conversation, Eric, I'd like to zoom in on and you as an individual. How has this experience changed you? Perhaps would be interesting to have your family, your wife, your kids comment on this too. Are there parts of you that are shaped and continue to operate here in Iowa with that background, with that still in your head, in your behavior?
It's funny you mention that, because my wife's probably listening to this and right this second. So yes, I think a lot of that is stuff I have internalized, really good at compartmentalizing things. And I would say that probably until coming to Iowa, where I wasn't necessarily associated with Department of Defense, either in uniform or as a civilian employee, like truly, you know, on a base and sort of stuff, I hadn't really had to face a lot of those things. And so, you know, God bless my wife for...
So what would be an example of transitioning back to this that you're aware of, like, wow, that is hanging on from that time in my, the way I'm thinking, the what I'm doing here?
So I would say just some of the, you know, internal dialogue that sometimes goes on in my particular head, I would say. I would say that, you know, one of the things that's a topic is, you know, veteran suicides. You know, 22 veterans or service members are killing themselves every day. I would be remiss if I didn't say that, you know, I could have been one of those individuals because of the challenges of, you know, coming back out of uniform and in what we would call normal everyday, you know, civilian life. A lot of the things that I experienced, I think, in uniform, and especially particularly in Afghanistan, as I kind of shared with you, a few of those nuggets are pretty vile and almost inconceivable in, you know, our first world view, and carrying those with you as kind of almost a litmus test that you, a lens that you filter through sometimes is a challenge. But, you know, thanks to my wife, she's really helped me, because she's a yoga instructor, and doing a lot of meditation, being able to be mindful and stuff like that has really, I think, helped me. And, you know, also seeking counseling and just talking through with other individuals who have either been there and done that or can relate to that has, at least for me, been very beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Is this something you communicate, how your view was changed when you were in this country? You saw their society operated much differently. They had much different values. Did it make you appreciate the family, the life you have here in the U.S. and Iowa? Do you communicate that with your kids, for instance?
I certainly try to. You know, probably on some days better than some. Yeah, we are so very fortunate. I know I'm very fortunate. Have a wife, kids. You know, where we're living, it's what do they call it, an attitude of gratitude. You know, you choose to see the good, because it's really easy to be cynical and to be judgmental and you know, get sucked down into that negativity. So I would definitely say, you know, it's a choice, seeing the glasses half full versus half empty.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much, Major Eldridge, Eric, for being with us this hour. Thank you, of course, for your service to our country. And thank you so much for sharing some of your thoughts about your deployment, your experiences, and the withdrawal here. Eric Eldridge, a retired major in the U.S. Marine Corps, from Keystone, Iowa, originally. Thank you so much, Eric.
Thanks, Ben.
And that's it for today. Just a quick reminder that if you served in Afghanistan or you know of someone who did who might like to share that experience, if you'd like to be considered, email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org.
This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including above and beyond cancer.
River to River, produced today by Rick Brewer. Our other producers, Matt Alvarez and Zachary Oren Smith. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of this program available at iowapublicradio.org or download our IPR app. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.